welcome. My name is Father C. John McCloskey. I'm director of the Catholic Information Center of the Archdiocese of Washington and priest of the Prelature Opus Dei. Welcome to another episode in our continuing EWTN series, exploring the life, work, and thought of the Venerable Cardinal John Henry Newman. Today's guest is Dr. John Crosby of the Franciscan University of Steubenville. He will be speaking to us and with us about Newman as philosopher. It's a particular pleasure to have Dr. Crosby. We are old friends from the early days of the pontificate of John Paul II in Rome. Dr. Crosby graduated from Georgetown University, received his doctorate in philosophy at the University of Salzburg in Austria. Dr. Crosby has six children, spent many years teaching at the University of Dallas, is now the chairman of the philosophy department, the Franciscan University of Steubenville. Dr. Crosby, thank you for being with us today.
A pleasure.
Perhaps
we could
start off by asking you about what attracted you as a person, as a philosopher, to the Venerable John Henry.
Well, my relationship to Newman goes back a long way. I, as a young boy, an adolescent, really having the usual doubts and questions that one has, came upon the writings of Newman, and I found answers to my questions in Newman more satisfying than I could find any place else. So that drew me to Newman, and then when I later got into philosophy, I saw this is a seminal thinker, very important for philosophy. So to this day, I am using Newman all the time, even in my teaching of philosophy.
Dr. Crosby is an expert on what we refer to as Christian personalism, with a specialty in thought of John Paul II and John Henry Newman. Perhaps you could give us a little background on what would have been the influences on Newman the philosopher.
Well, you know, Newman never really studied philosophy in any formal way. He read some classics as part of the general study of the Latin and Greek classics, which was the Oxford education in his day. One source of philosophic formation, I think, was his study of the Greek fathers of the church. They formed the mind and imagination of Newman really like no one else. And so a certain amount of Platonic, that is, philosophy of Plato and Augustine, flowed into Newman. And I think there's also a certain amount of the Englishman, the English respect for the concrete. He somehow drank that in. As an Englishman, but Newman, I think, is one of those seminal geniuses who rises far above all of his sources and influences. So he doesn't typify a school, but he's a kind of maverick there, with a brand new voice, breaking new ground in philosophy.
We've often heard that in our various other episodes about him as being a sui generis. It's very hard to classify him, really, and as such, he's a founder in many ways of particular currents of thought. As I mentioned a moment ago, this idea of Christian personalism, which is so much alive today in the church, is reflected in Blessed Edith Stein or the Holy Father himself. Maybe you could explain to us, what is Christian personalism?
Yeah, well, I've actually written this book, The Selfhood of the Human Person, just back in 96, on this topic, and my work there on the human person is very much inspired by Carol Wojtyla, John Paul II, and by Newman. He appears repeatedly in my pages. And what I attempt to do in that book is explore this mystery of each person as unrepeatable, as not just, you know, a specimen of the humankind, but as an absolutely unrepeatable person who, if destroyed, could never be replaced, you know, by a follow-up copy.
Now, this fits in very much with the idea of coming particularly from the Second Vatican Council, but the Holy Father never stops repeating it, of the dignity of the human person.
That's very connected with the fact that persons are not just specimens of the human species, but that each is unrepeatably himself, like an unrepeatable word spoken by God. And with that goes an incomparable dignity or worth that the Pope is always witnessing to. And I think personalism is a very good way of approaching Newman. As I was telling you, there's this wonderful sentence in one of the great studies of Newman as philosopher, actually the book ends like this. Newman stands at the threshold of the New Age as a Christian Socrates, the pioneer of a new philosophy of the individual person and personal life. And I think most of what's really fascinating in Newman philosophically has some connection to the human person.
Well, it's wonderful that you mentioned the threshold. Here we are at the threshold of hope, the threshold of the
new millennium.
The new millennium, moving on into the new millennium, the great hope that we have as Catholics, and sharing this great vision of the Holy Father. Now, you mentioned in terms of Christian personalism in Newman, at a certain point, the fact that he was English and his love for the concrete.
Maybe that
could serve as an introduction into a little bit of his theory of belief.
Good. Newman really is fascinated with the concrete individual and has this tremendous respect for the individual and all his concreteness, and is very wary of stereotypes and universals by which we think of individuals. And you see it in his sermons. He frequently will say to his listeners something like this: you profess a belief in the immortality of the soul, but you don't realize it yet. And I want now to help you to realize it. So Newman distinguishes between thinking very abstractly about something and keeping it at a distance to yourself, and thinking very concretely, so that the truth that you're related to concretely can really have force in your life and move you. And Newman has a tremendous ability to make truths that you've professed as true for a long time, to make them concrete. And as he puts it in one place, to come home to your heart, piercing the heart because of the concrete. Give you a concrete example. Take the idea that I will one day die. Now, I can think very abstractly about that because everybody will one day die, and I'm part of everybody, so I too will one day die. Well, that's to think very abstractly, or as Newman said, very notionally about my death. But in a moment of deep recollection, I may come to realize that I will one day die. Forget about the rest of humanity, the mortality of man as such. I, as this concrete person, will one day die. Then my conviction becomes what Newman says, a real assent. First it was just notional, now it's concrete and it's real. And Newman was so keen on Christians having real assent because only when the truth is really and concretely grasped does it have power over our lives.
A person with real assent very likely will make a particular effort in their own interior life, their relationship with God, to better it, and also have an impetus to share that life with others.
Right, exactly. Or, to say with that example of my own death, I'm going to draw the consequences and live differently once I realize the fact that I will one day die. Whereas it's so abstract, if I think, well, everybody dies and so will I, that it has no real power over my life.
Many of our viewers, I should say all of our viewers, I'm sure, along with being interested in the concept of death, are very interested in the relationship between belief and faith.
Right.
And how do we believe? How does faith, this gift that is given to us, work with belief? And then how it's integrated in our lives. And Cardinal Newman, of course, wrote the seminal work, The Grammar of Assent, which is a book I think it's fair to say is not overly accessible to most people.
But I would not recommend that our viewers interested in Newman start with that.
But perhaps you could tell us a little bit in a kernel of what's Newman's theory of how we come to believe.
The idea that I just mentioned, this difference of real and notional assent, the abstract and the concrete grasp of truth, that occupies a large part in The Grammar of Assent. And, of course, what Newman is mainly concerned with is giving a real assent to the existence of God. Perhaps what would most interest our viewers is the famous discussion of conscience in The Grammar of Assent. And you have to remember, Newman is not so much trying to talk to atheists. It's not that he's trying to show that God exists to people who say he doesn't exist. He's talking primarily to conventional Christians who affirm notionally that God exists. And he wants to give them this real assent. And so Newman says conscience is a unique place of personal encounter with God. And there we can get not just true theories and true general principles, but in conscience, we encounter God personally because of obligation. In conscience, we find ourselves morally abound, and this makes us awaken as person, and we're aware, if we're sensitive in conscience, that we are bound by the living God. And so all deeper experience of being obliged, of being called to repentance, is really a kind of glimpse of God who makes himself felt. The echo of his voice resonates in conscience, as the Second Vatican Council put it.
Doesn't Newman speak somewhere about the importance that to believe is to love?
Right.
That we have to, in order to come to believe, it's not simply a question of passivity, of waiting to be.
Exactly. That's a very important part of Newman's teaching, that religious belief is not a purely intellectual matter, but we have to employ the intellect, but we have to love, and with our whole moral being we come to know God and to develop this real assent to him. So he says in one place that the rays of God's truth stream in not just through the intellect but through our moral being too. And so it's not just intelligence but great love that is required to go very far in religious belief.
Could you explain to us why or how Newman would explain in the grammar why we believe?
Yeah.
Why can we have a real assent? Why do we have a real assent to the truths that are revealed to us? On account of what?
Yeah, well, perhaps you're thinking of Newman's very fascinating discussion of how we reason about matters of faith. And Newman, you know, the motto of the Grammar of Assent is this famous line from St. Ambrose that God did not want to redeem his people by means of logic.
In dialecta non complacuit Deo.
Right, in dialectica. So not just by logic. And so Newman was aware of how he reasoned on his way into the Catholic Church, and he realized it was not, you know, a schematic reasoning, not like the kind of reasoning, you know, you did in algebra or geometry. You've got a few steps and then comes the conclusion. But the reasoning that Newman used to become a Catholic was a reasoning that engaged the whole man, as he says, mind and heart. And it was a very personal thing. Each person does this reasoning that leads him to faith in his own way. So Newman explores there in the Grammar of Assent this very personal activity of bringing together all the truth that you know and summing it up and finding what truth about God it points to.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the great ideas in the Grammar of Assent, this reasoning, the whole man, and the real assent, not just the notional assent at the end of the process of reasoning.
Doesn't he not also speak, I believe it's one of the last chapters, the Grammar of Assent, is an example of the real assent to the faith is the life of the martyrs.
Right, exactly.
The early martyrs of Christianity.
Right, exactly. He thought that the witness of these martyrs was a very compelling reason for believing. And so when he makes a kind of defense of the Christian faith, he makes large use of these early Christian martyrs. He thought that's Newman's personalism. He thought that the personal witness of these martyrs had a unique convicting power for me, who am searching. And so that's typical of Newman, that his argument for Christianity is not in terms of abstract principles, but concrete personal witnesses. That's what led him to faith. And of course, Newman led so many people to faith by the concrete witness of his own life.
We refer to it, and we've brought up this phrase other times in our episodes, this idea of the personal influence that is exerted.
Yeah.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, that
the
Newman
personality
reflects a great deal on personal influence. He He didn't really expect anything from organized media campaigns. Mm. He didn't think that truth is really disseminated in any very deep way on that level. But he thought that all real deep influence goes from one person to another.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly led so many people to the faith in that very personal way. Newman's writings have the wonderful ability to express Newman, the individual person, so that even if you don't know him, but read his works in this century, mm-hmm. why you feel that personal influence and can be led to faith like Newman led many of his contemporaries to faith.
Could you speak to us of, I think you've alluded to it, mm-hmm. it's a phrase that's oftentimes used mm-hmm. that Cardinal Newman used and may not be that accessible to all of us, the illative sense. Right. What does Newman mean by that?
The illative sense, that's a basic concept in the grammar of assent and refers to this way of reasoning which is not just a matter of pure paper logic, like Newman used to say, but where the whole man has to reason. One of his favorite examples that everybody will understand is, how do you prove that England is an island? This was before you could see it from a satellite. And Newman said, well, all of English history assumes that it's an island. All the maps say that it's an island. Nobody's ever denied that it's an island. But he said, you can't really prove it. What you do is you collate lots of strands of information and come by means of the illative sense.
A convergence?
A convergence of probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
As he put it, they all converge on one point. And so he thought in religion, too, that when he looked into the Catholic faith, that there was gradually this tremendous convergence from many different sides on the truth of the Catholic faith. And so by means of the illative sense, he reasoned his way to the threshold of faith in the Church.
Mm-hmm. We've come up to the point where it might be interesting to talk about this concept of mystery.
Yeah.
But Newman himself was regarded by many
right.
as somewhat of an ethereal
right.
presence.
Right.
He was shy and timid
yeah.
and
yeah.
and recondite, if
right.
we use that word.
Yeah.
And mysterious was oftentimes applied to him personally,
right.
but in yeah. his own writings
yeah.
as a philosopher, the sense
right.
of mystery, the sense
right.
of wonder. Could
right.
you talk
yeah.
about that?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most significant things about Newman as a thinker, this profound sense of mystery that he has. He never takes things just for granted. You know, this bourgeois taking them for granted is completely foreign to his mind. He's always caught up in wonder about things and realizes how little we really know about them. And obviously with the mysteries of faith, that goes far beyond what we understand. But Newman has a keen eye for mysteries that are very close to home, like with regard to the animals.
Mm-hmm.
Newman was again and again, you see it in his writings, caught up in amazement. What is an animal? He says in one place, we understand better what an angel is than what an animal is. Because this conscious life that the animal has, this feeling, and yet not being a person, that was very mysterious for Newman. And there's a wonderful passage where he's talking about the mystery of the Trinity. And he's trying to, help his listeners to accept that mystery of the Trinity, and he argues like this: look, you shouldn't balk at the mystery of the Trinity because you're a mystery to yourself. And there's this wonderful passage on the unity of body and soul. How is it that this non-material principle of the soul informs a body? He says that's like a wish existing in a stone. What sense does that make? Who can understand it? And so he says, you're already living with tremendous mystery about yourself. So it's hardly surprising that when God gives a revelation of himself, there's mystery in it. But that's why I think this name, a Christian Socrates, is good, because Socrates, was famous for saying, I know that I don't know. And in a way, Newman does that in a Christian setting. I mean, he always affirms the dogmas of the faith. There's this dogmatical principle that is the very backbone of Newman. And so revealed truth is affirmed with an uncompromising faithfulness. It's necessary for salvation. And yet at the same time, Newman, he's not what philosophers call a rationalist, who thinks they have an answer for everything. But
don't you have the sense that Cardinal Newman would have been a great researcher, a biologist, a chemist? I mean, his capacity to get into things, to look at them objectively, but also with great throwing himself into...
Yes, he would have been a great researcher, but one of those really great ones who, at the end of his research, after he's discovered a lot of new things, knows how much he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of
the researcher
Newman would have been. And you know, one other thing about Newman on mystery, he not only acknowledges mystery, but he almost rejoices in it. In the sermons, he'll say, we can't under... for instance, in one sermon on the Ascension, why did Christ have to leave so that the Spirit could come? Who can understand this? And then Newman breaks out in a kind of prayer of adoration. It's as if we encounter God, you know, in all of his greatness, just when he's most mysterious. And so Newman wasn't uncomfortable, but relished, somehow reveled in the mysteriousness of God, because that let us really encounter God as God.
Perhaps we talk just for a few moments on the relationship of Karol Wojtyła, our present Holy Father, and John Henry Newman. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Pope has deep appreciation, evidently, is expressed in speeches and writings. Do you think that the Pope, in his Christian personalism, might have been, in one way or another, influenced by the thought of the Venerable John Henry?
You know, I don't think there's a great direct influence there. In fact, I once had the great privilege of, in meeting the Holy Father, to ask him about his relationship to Newman. And it was never a major influence. He discovered Newman only much later. But what we have, I think, is more of a convergence of two great original Christian thinkers coming together in this personalism, this sense of the mystery of the human person that connects the two. When I did ask the Holy Father about his relationship to Newman, he did say he had just been reading the Oxford University sermons of Newman.
As Pope, he was reading
that. As Pope, he was reading that, and he was profoundly impressed.
In his spare time.
Yeah, in his spare time between encyclicals and world trips. He said he was profoundly impressed by the depth of thought. And it's perhaps worth mentioning that book, because viewers who want to get a little bit into Newman's philosophy but don't want to get into something too heavy, like the Grammar of Assent, might look at the volume, The Oxford University Sermons.
Which are in print.
They are in print.
Are you sure you'd be able to find them in through a local bookstore or a website?
That's right. And it, you can find most of the themes of Newman's philosophy in a fairly readable form. These are addresses given to a broad, non-specialist audience.
How does Newman, we have a whole program dedicated to the essay and development of doctrine, but how does Newman's philosophical approach work itself into that truly seminal work, maybe the greatest work of theology in the last two centuries, arguably, or most influential in any case, of the idea of continuity and history and the consciousness?
Well, I think it's a part of Newman's personalism, this strong sense of the role of time in entering into the truth, the need of the human mind to unfold first one aspect, then another aspect, and gradually, over time, come into full possession of the truth. So I think Newman noticed more than any previous Catholic historian and theologian this historical dimension to Christian doctrine. And I think that he really, while holding fast to doctrine, given once and for all, necessary for salvation, at the same time, he explores with great boldness this element of development. And you know, he uses the analogy with the mustard seed, the smallest of seeds that grows into the biggest of trees. That's Christian doctrine, over the ages, responding to different heresies, to different cultures, each time some new aspect of the faith that was, in some sense, always there from the beginning, but now it's articulated. So we have this development of doctrine over time. But what Newman is doing there is giving more attention to the human side, not just to God's truth, but to man's appropriation of it, how human beings grow into it and come into fuller possession of it. And so that's why I would reckon this, too, to the personalism of Newman.
If there was one smaller book that might examine the question of belief and faith that might be available to our viewers, do you have any recommendations in that regard?
You know, there is that fine book of Joseph Pieper on belief and faith.
Another one of your old friends.
Yeah, well, he's a few generations ahead of me, but I esteem greatly all these books of Pieper, and Pieper, for his part, esteems and uses Newman there.
And that's in the first volume, I believe, of Faith, Hope, and Charity, available
through
Ignatius Press.
Yeah, with Ignatius, yeah, that's a splendid work on Newman. But there's nothing like reading Newman himself, as I say, already as a teenager. It really caught my fancy and satisfied my mind like nothing else. And so those Oxford University sermons are a good place to begin.
Well, thank you today for being with us. It's been a pleasure, as always, to hear you on Newman. Mm-hmm. And the viewers of EWTN are going to be very interested soon to see Dr. Crosby with his own series on the thought of John Paul II, two great men of the 19th and 20th century, who converged so closely together. And I thank you, our viewers, for being with us once again for this series, Newman at 2000, on the thought, the work, person, and influence of the Venerable John Henry Cardinal Newman. We continue to use his intercession to pray for our personal needs, and also that God may raise him someday to the altars, and that he may be indeed what has been spoken about as Doctor of the Church. Mm-hmm.